From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccans. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, which off-air, still working on a title for this one. I don't know what we'll end up with, but I was pitching it to the gang as the episode where we start a fight with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. What are we talking about? There's so many beef points between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, or the world and the kingdom. Here's the scoop. Today's episode may be a sensitive subject to many in the audience. It touches on several ongoing legal cases, many of which will likely not be resolved for one reason or another. You might not be aware of this one, but it is an international conspiracy. It's at least a decade old, probably older. It continues as we record today, and there's not a solution, really. It is set to continue in the future. The best way for us to get into this story is to explore it through a specific recent example in Oregon. That just hit a crisis point in 2019, but it begins in 2016. So here are the facts.
Yes. On August 19th of 2016, Abdul Rahman Samir Nurah was charged with first degree manslaughter for fatally hitting a 15-year-old girl named Fallon Smart with his car in Portland. The charge was technically elevated manslaughter. We've talked about the weirdness behind these types of kind of delineations of styles of murder. But yeah, elevated manslaughter alleges that Nurah caused Smart's death unlawfully and recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. Whew. Okay. Smart was crossing legally in front of traffic when Nurah illegally swerved into the left turn lane and hit her at 55 to 60 miles per hour. Nurah was driving on a suspended license, did not stop after running over this person, and police said that he later returned to the scene, which I guess the indication there is just kind of wanton disregard for, you know, consequences, perhaps, but we'll see.
Well, I mean, he's going back to see what happened, right?
Oh, yeah, but also, like, that's a luxury, I would say. Like, if I was going to flee, I would fully flee. I wouldn't be like, let's go back and see what happened. So that's a little bit interesting.
Yeah, he was likely, this is my speculation, he was likely instructed by someone to return and assured that things would ultimately be okay. He had been in the U.S. for some time. He first visited the country in 2014 from his native Saudi Arabia. He was on a student visa, as you know, many people travel to the U.S. on a student visa. He was studying at Portland Community College. The Saudi Arabian government, through its consulate, retained private attorneys, one of whom will occur later in this story, Ginger Mooney, and they cut his bail was, I think, initially set at $1 million. So they cut a $100,000 check for his bail. He was put on pretrial supervision, kind of like house arrest, ankle monitor, the bracelet, the whole nine, and his passport was taken. That's important because typically in the world of legal international travel, there is only one living person right now who can travel without a passport. That is the Queen of England. Weird story. It's true. I think we have a video about it somewhere. Brain stuff or stuff they don't want you to know. So here's where our Law and Order music starts kicking in. 2 weeks before his trial, which was scheduled for June 2017, Nurah disappears. A black SUV is seen pulling into the home where he's staying at. He was staying with a host family along with a cousin he was very close to. We know that he was driven to a gravel lot about 2 miles away. And we know this because he still had his tracking monitor on his ankle. So the feds followed that signal to the gravel lot and found that someone had sliced the monitor off and just discarded it. There were also cell phone, laptop stuff involved here. From there, federal authorities in the U.S. believed Nora, who is, by the way, just 21 at this point. He's a young kid. He was given a fake or illicit passport, and he was flown somehow out of the U.S., likely on a private plane.
And you may be wondering, wow, this guy must be really important. For that to go down, or he must be extremely rich to be able to get someone to do that. Either someone did that for him, or he did it on his own accord. It's very strange. Just the fact that a precaution would be taken, like a pretty extreme precaution, taking a passport, making sure, okay, this person is not going to leave. And then to be able to have an organized group of people to assist in getting this person out of the country, there's something deeper going on. It feels like a movie. Like some kind of spy movie or a caper, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because look, you know, I complained about this off air earlier. I can't get away with overdue library fees. You know what I mean? Like, I have consequences for that. How did this guy give the feds the slip and get out of the country? What's happening? The thing is, federal prosecutors, without disclosing all of the specifics of their information other than what we've just mentioned, federal prosecutors are certain that the Saudi Arabian government itself conspired to remove Nora before he could face any actual jail time for killing this child. And, you know, for the record, it doesn't seem like it was premeditated murder. It feels like it was a horrific accidental tragedy. But that doesn't bring the kid back to life.
Reckless, yeah. And you know, I joked about the lines that we make in the law between different types of killing. And obviously, some of them exist for a reason: premeditated versus an accident, a tragedy, something that you participated in but perhaps did not actually intend to do. I understand that. But this is also, you know, there's a level of wantonness and a level of disregard for human life on display here that is very troubling, at the very least.
Yeah, the authorities noted, like the local police in Portland noted, that at the time Nora seemed markedly indifferent to the fact that there was someone dead because of his driving. But we have to be careful with that kind of emotional attribution, because he could have just been in shock.
Also,
you know what I mean? Here's the thing. You've probably heard of extradition treaties. You don't have to be a legal expert to know what they are. Extradition treaties are agreements that countries make, or that agreements that either individual countries make bilaterally, or they're agreements that coalitions like the EU will make for EU member states. Not every country has an extradition treaty with every other country, which is how some people are able to fake their deaths and get away and live in a non-extradition country. And when the authorities find out that they've committed pseudocide, which is the correct word, it doesn't matter if those people are faking their death, because you can't get them back to your country to face their crimes. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia do not have an extradition treaty. So it is highly unlikely that Nora would be arrested inside the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for this crime in the U.S., and it is virtually impossible. It would be unprecedented for the kingdom to actually send one of their own citizens to the U.S. to serve time in the U.S. prison system. Currently, the feds say they don't know specifically where Nora is in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So, in short, all the details aside, the main takeaway is this. He killed a child, a 15-year-old, and he got away with it. And it gets worse.
Boy, does it ever.
And as we said, this took place in Portland, Oregon, and there's a journalist there working for the Oregonian, also known as Oregon Live. His name is Shane Dixon Kavanaugh, and he's been looking into this pretty extensively. There are many, many articles you can read on the websites there to learn about this. And he has found that it appears that this isn't just a one-off. This isn't an exception to the rule. This seems to be a much larger issue, a pattern of people getting away with terrible things in the United States and being sent back to Saudi Arabia somehow.
Right. I like that you point out this as an iteration of a pattern. This is our conspiracy for today. How many people has the government of Saudi Arabia removed from justice? And perhaps more importantly and more disturbingly, why aren't the feds doing anything about it? This is a question we'll answer after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy. So, Kavanaugh, if you're listening, thank you for doing this amazing work. I was profoundly impressed. Kavanaugh has made a series that is ongoing called Fleeing Justice, which is available now at OregonLive.com. In his investigation, he breadcrumbed together dozens of cases of Saudi Arabian nationals, typically young college students, illegally fleeing the U.S. and Canada after being charged with serious crimes. And we're not talking about stuff like late fees at Blockbuster or libraries or something.
Is that a crime? Late fees at Blockbuster? Because if so, I am a criminal.
I still think about that. Like, how different would the world be? Maybe I should have paid those late fees.
What happens when the company like dissolves? I mean, there is technically one remaining active Blockbuster. But Ben, to your earlier point, the public library, they are relentless. They will come after you. They will, like, you know, dox you. And it's very scary to be on the wrong side of the public library system.
Yeah, the word on the street is that librarians trained under the most elite hounding force in the U.S., which is, of course, people who want to talk to you about your car's extended warranty. They're pretty much the SEAL Team 6 of bugging you. But I'm kidding.
It's true.
but look, we're trying to inject levity into this because these individuals were charged with, not convicted, but charged with things like manslaughter, rape, more kinds of sexual assault, illegal possession of firearms, possession of graphic depictions of child abuse, and charges of like encouraging, soliciting, disseminating that kind of material. Kavanaugh found these. And then he also found, he was the one who originally reported this story that we just shared with you at the top of the show. He also found a pattern of state level interference from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia with each of these cases. And then he found that this has been an open secret among federal authorities for at least a decade. I would argue probably more. Like everybody, it just wasn't getting reported near as often until Kavanaugh started digging it.
Yes. And for the record, I've always been a big fan of the Oregonian and the reporting they've done, a show that I worked on that I've mentioned a couple times. No, we actually had Phil Stanford, who once wrote for the Oregonian, on the show, and they've definitely done good work in investigative journalism over the years. This series from Kavanaugh began when he learned about this particular case involving Nurah. Kavanaugh, through tons of deep dive research, was able to conclude, and this is a quote from the piece, "Despite unknowns in the ongoing investigation, officials with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and U.S. Marshals Service are all but certain who helped orchestrate the remarkable escape, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And therein lies a pattern." This is no longer in the quote, "that the Saudi government paid bail, hired attorneys to defend nearly all of these young men, most of whom were international college students at the time. And in each case, they were able to extract them before they were forced to face prosecution or complete jail sentences. Some were traced back to Saudi Arabia, even after surrendering their passports to U.S. authorities. And to your point, Ben, that's crazy. That's a level of like cheat code, you know, boss move that most are not capable of, and definitely requires some kind of level of collusion on the part of our government. I'm just putting that out there.
And then they realized, you know, there are several cases in Oregon. You know, you if you imagine Kavanaugh working there at a paper that's based in the city, he's looking at cases that are happening around him, right? And then he and his team discover that, oh, no, it's not just Oregon. There's other cases like this in Montana, in Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Utah, Washington, Wisconsin. And they're realizing, oh, my God, this is happening across the U.S.
and beyond. They also find two cases in Nova Scotia. Saudi students in two separate incidents had skipped bail and they had disappeared after being accused of sexual assault. I think it's fair to say disappeared because they end up back at the kingdom. That's what happens. They may go somewhere else to some other country after that, but they go back to their home country in Saudi Arabia. To your point, Matt, in Oregon, Kavanaugh's team found seven cases they could verify involving Saudi nationals who vanished before they faced trial or completed the jail sentence. These were two people accused of rape, a pair of suspected hit-and-run drivers, one of whom was Nura, one man accused of having depictions of child abuse on his computer, sexual assault charges, one man accused of carrying a loaded illegal firearm. And that's like that one is the lightest crime, that guy. All of these people were young men studying at colleges or universities in Oregon with assistance from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia at the time of their arrest. I want to give a comparison here, and we'll make sure that we're not just picking on Saudi Arabia before this episode is over. So spoiler alert, but I want to make a comparison. Folks, conspiracy realists, imagine that you went on a trip with Matt Knoll, Mission Control, and myself, and we were, I don't know, we're backpacking around Croatia, or we're doing a tour in China. Wishes or horses, they let us in. I don't want to accuse us of heinous crimes, but let's say one of us commits a heinous crime. You know what?
Well, let's just say an accidental death.
Right? Okay, because, yeah. Let's say we get in a bar fight. We get in a bar fight and don't mean to kill somebody, but one of us kills somebody and the government of Croatia or the government of China rightly says, you're under arrest. But then if we were like these nationals in today's episode, what would happen is that the government of the U.S., or let's just say the government of podcasting then would find a smart spycraft way to contact us, right, and communicate with us through obtuse or clandestine means. And then they would essentially say, Matt, if you're the person who accidentally threw the fatal punch, then they would essentially say, okay, we're going to post your bail, right? You're on house arrest.
Okay. Cool.
At 12:43 p.m. on, you know, this Tuesday, just walk outside, stop at the threshold of your door so the ankle monitor doesn't ping. And then when the car pulls up, hop in, don't ask any questions. And then they'll hand you a real looking U.S. passport that says like real guy last name or something, you know,
yeah.
And it's got your picture on it. And then boom, you're in the U.S. You'll never get to go to Zagreb or Croatia or Beijing or China again, but you'll also never serve a day in jail. That doesn't happen to the average person in the planet. And it shouldn't, right? Like, is that not crazy? That's insane to me.
It is crazy. And it's very similar to what we've discussed before when a spy who is operating under diplomatic immunity or something is operating in a different country, right? Doesn't it feel like that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know we're going to get there, but it's just, it's galling to me. It's like, this doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, I mean, there's somebody helping the process along the way. Is it sanctioned? Is it completely under the table just to keep the relationship, you know, nice and tidy with this country that we depend on?
These are good questions, Noel. We need to delve further, though.
The answer is
no.
Disgusting.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
that's the spoiler I'll give now. We didn't want to go too far down the rabbit hole. Again, you can read reports by ProPublica. You can reports by The Oregonian and a couple of other high quality outlets about this. But just to give you the scope, like, we want to name some of these people. So picture Kavanaugh again, picking up the breadcrumbs, putting the pieces together here. In addition to Nora, he found multiple people, as we said, like around 20. There's Mohammed Zarabi al-Zawabi. He's one of the Nova Scotia folks in 2018. He disappeared. He was facing numerous charges of sexual assault and forcible confinement of a woman over a series of incidences occurring between 2015 and 2017.
There's Sami Suleiman al-Mizani. He was in Montana. This is in 2017. He was accused of raping his roommate after the pair returned home from a downtown music festival in July of 2017.
Next, we have Mukrin Majah al-Balawi, and this took place in Washington in 2016. He was accused of beating and stabbing a man during an altercation in February of 2016.
And then there's Saud Abdulatif, who in Washington in 2016 disappeared. He had forcibly confined someone, unlawful imprisonment it was called, and had forced her to perform sex acts upon him.
Oh, my God. I'm assuming, Ben, so many of these are from the Pacific Northwest because of the reporting from The Oregonian?
Yeah. I listed out the seven cases, but eventually, just for the sake of time, I stopped. And I want to, again, recommend that people check out Kavanaugh's work on this, because it's super easy to rabbit hole. You'll see, like, we've got links arranged where you can see the story and the particulars of each of these cases. You'll also see other ones that haven't been reported or maybe collected in this series for one reason or another, but there are cases that occur in other places, in Milwaukee and so on. In Oregon, Saud Ali Al-Gawais, he disappeared in 2016. He's the illegal firearm guy. He currently has a couple of outstanding warrants in a couple of counties. I'm going to be honest, to me, having a non-registered firearm feels lighter. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And next we've got Suleiman Ali Al-Gawais. This is again in Oregon. This guy was charged with third degree assault. He's also charged with driving under the influence of something that was intoxicating him. There were other charges laid against him, and that was in 2016.
Would they have been related? Saud and Suleiman, same exact last name, or Ali Al-Gawais.
You know, I do not know if they are officially related, but we're going to get into some troubling relations a little bit later in the episode.
Got it. Next, we have Faisal Al-Taleb, and this was in Montana in 2016, and the charge here was sexual assault.
And then we have Abdulaziz Hamad Al-Dawais in Oregon, 2015, accused of sexually assaulting a classmate after plying her with marijuana and booze.
And then we have Walid Ali Al-Harthi, and this was also in Oregon in 2015, and this was possession of child pornography. I mean, these charges run the gamut of, so wide-ranging.
And as we said, the list goes on. There is value in naming specific people here so that we're not just saying this number of folks, right, are part of this pattern or iterations thereof. And you're right, they run the gamut, but there is one thing they have in common, which is that these people did not and will not pay for their crimes. they exist in a different level of justice than, you know, most of us listening along today, unless you are one of the people named and you happen to be listening to this episode, in which case, feel free to reach out, conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Yeah, and we're talking about this almost in terms of, like, you know, extraction or some kind of, you know, heist, but it's in none of these cases was there an actual breaking out. You know, these were all done more or less using the traditional means of paying bail and using lawyers and all of that. So on paper, it could easily be justified that this was done through the proper channels. But as we'll see, there's nothing proper about any of this.
I hear what you're saying, Noel, but when we're talking about proper channels, a proper channel is not escaping the country illegally.
Oh, 100%.
Right? That's why it's so troubling.
No, I'm a million percent. I'm just saying, like, you know, paper trail wise, you know, they paid the bail, they got them out, and then they fled, you know?
Well, they skipped bail, I think, right? That's how you would say it.
Yeah, they skipped bail, and it's got to be irritating to the skip tracers, because there you can trace some of these individuals pretty easily. You just cannot do anything about it. So yeah, they go through the proper channels up to a point, and we'll see the response of the Saudi government to some of these crazy accusations a little later in the show. It is important, again, to be objective, to be fair. We have to note that these individuals were accused, they were suspected, they were arrested or indicted, but there hasn't been, to your point, Noel, an actual jailbreak, you know, like that prison escape show that was so popular a few years ago. It wasn't like a tank rolled through or someone dressed as, I'm just thinking how cool this is in movies. Someone dressed as a prison guard, like, takes off their Mission Impossible mask face and it's Tom Cruise or something. It's like, we're getting you out of the States. Nothing like that. Nothing like that, but close enough, a real world version of it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of really great reporting on this, to your point, Ben. And according to Sebastian Rotella and Tim Golden, who write for ProPublica, they had this to say about the whole situation. Quote, successive American administrations have avoided confronting the government in Riyadh out of concern that doing so might jeopardize U.S. interests, particularly Saudi cooperation in the fight against Islamist terrorism.
So they knew. They knew about this. Again, they just did very little to prevent it. And Mission Control, Paul Mission Control brought up a great point. He was asking me off air. He said, okay, well, why is this happening? And that's it in a nutshell. And when we told him, his next response was counterterrorism. Weren't the majority of the terrorists involved in the events of September 11th Saudi nationals? And that's correct. So, to be fair, a spokesperson for the Saudi embassy in Washington named Fahad Nazir said that, quote, only a small fraction of Saudi students in the U.S. have gotten into any legal trouble, and that Saudi officials have strictly adhered to all U.S. laws in helping them. He goes on to say, the notion that the Saudi government actively helps citizens evade justice after they've been implicated in legal wrongdoing in the U.S. is simply not true. I put a little sass on that quote because it feels categorical and explicit, but it seems that that quote itself is at the very least misleading. Maybe the people who are assisting in these escapes are kind of like hackers, the hacker armies in China. Maybe they're just not officially condoned by the government and they just feel patriotic. Or he's lying.
Well, that's the thing, though. Like, I mean, when you get into all this, like, PR speak, and again, this idea of strictly adhering to all U.S. laws, there's a dot, dot, dot there where it's up to a point. Like you said, mm-hmm. You can certainly say we strictly adhered to all U.S. laws, and then we didn't until the point where we stopped doing that thing.
Well, Again, you'd have to prove that it's Saudi officials who are doing any taking any of these actions to get citizens out.
That's
plausible deniability, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're it's a tough thing unless you've got solid evidence to say, hey, Saudi Arabia, you have government officials taking people out of the country, and we know it. You'd have to have serious evidence in order to make that accusation.
Well, and while maybe we don't have that, we do have a disturbing trend, an upward trend that we can measure. And it would seem that the problem of U.S. students fleeing prosecution has increased largely in proportion to the Saudi student population in the United States increasing. That population having been only 5,000 in 2005, and then about a decade later exploding to more than 80,000. And that's according to the Department of Homeland Security. The Saudi government has sponsored most of these students under a scholarship program created by the late King Abdullah, a $3 billion, mind you, dollar scholarship program.
Yeah, so maybe it's just a numbers game question. There are so many more apples that maybe our incident of bad apples just increases, right? The FBI, State Department, ICE, the rest of the Alphabet boys, all the Alphabet Soup members have confirmed, to your point, Matt, that Saudi intelligence officials do monitor Saudi nationals in the United States. And they confirm this as part of their kind of routine security checks. You know what I mean? It's not a big Operation Snow White break into an embassy or something. This is standard operating procedure. So what they saw the intelligence officials doing was the Saudi intelligence officials doing was looking for signs of possible radicalization, right? Looking for signs of denigration against the kingdom, stuff like that. Just keeping an eye on these people because, again, that is part and parcel of what they do, right? I mean, even like if you're a U.S. citizen and you travel to a foreign country, and you're going to be living there for a while. It's also highly recommended that you check in with the embassy or the consulate in case something happens, right? Again, the U.S. consulate is not, for the average U.S. citizen, the U.S. consulate is not going to go to these lengths. You know what I mean? They're not going to spirit you away. Or what do we say in the troubled teen industry? They're not going to goon you out.
Yeah, the goon squad.
Of a situation. Right. Yeah, you put yourself in. But they found something else when they were looking at this. The officials found that the Saudi intelligence agents were also not just keeping tabs on the college kids, but intervening where they felt necessary, up to and including assisting them in escaping criminal consequences that would put the average U.S. citizen pretty much under the jail. Like celebrities, the very wealthy, and politicians obviously have a function under a different justice system. But the average U.S. citizen would be going to prison for a lot of this stuff. So can you guess why Uncle Sam has not been doing a damn thing about this for more than 10 years? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. We're back, and we hope that you have returned as well. We left you with a question, and we shouldn't have left you without a dope beat to step to. Here it is. Can you guess why Uncle Sam has not been doing anything about it? Wait for it, folks. If you're listening along at home and you already know the answer, please say it with us. The greater good.
Love it.
The greater good.
It's just the greatest, you know?
Yeah.
It's
the greatest.
The most good.
Yeah.
For all.
Yeah. And what do we mean? The greater good.
Don't upset the apple cart is what we mean. We've got these. Well, I don't know. It just means that we don't want to. It's like if you compare, it's like a cost benefit analysis we always talk about. Like if we do we really want to die on this hill of going to war with the Saudi government over these like misbehaving students, which in the grand scheme of things, you know, Uncle Sam could easily argue not that big a deal when you compare it to like the overall picture of things.
And we've got a quote from someone who seems to know what they're talking about, a former FBI agent named Jeffrey Danik. He was the FBI's assistant legal attaché in Riyadh from 2010 to 2012. And this is why he thinks these students are somehow getting back to Saudi Arabia while the FBI and other intelligence agencies are aware. He says, "It's not that the issue of Saudi fugitives from the U.S. wasn't important. It's that the security relationship was so much more important. On counterterrorism, on protecting the U.S. and its partners, on opposing Iran, the Saudis were invaluable allies."
So, yeah, this argument is a greater good argument. It's a cost-benefit analysis argument. Not everybody is making the same argument for the people who would speak, whether on record or anonymously. There were people who were saying, look, if this came across my desk at the time, I would have no problem approaching whomever my contact was in the kingdom regarding this issue, even if it's a painful one to bring up. But then you'll have people from other U.S. agencies who are saying, look, I have to build relationships with my partners on these projects, on counterterrorism. I have to ask sensitive questions to do a lot of digging, and I have to have rapport and I have to have trust. And if I'm there to talk with these folks about something concerning geopolitics or national security, and I bring up, hey, where are these college kids? Then I will be shut down. And not only will I have an unsuccessful conversation or interaction that day, but I will never recover from pressing this point. The problem with this is that both sides are valid. But if we wanted to be hyperbolic then and engage in some like bleeding headlines, then we would say something like, the U.S. has made a conscious decision to sacrifice some of its civilians. That's a terrible thing to say, and it is misleading, and it's an appeal to emotion and so on. But this kind of stuff, also, these kind of decisions don't occur in a vacuum. There are other things that happen, like the U.S. protecting opium fields in Afghanistan. You know what I mean? Like, you could say that they're enabling opioid addiction and heroin addiction in the U.S. Also, shout out to the cost of doing business argument. I think you guys saw makers of OxyContin just got slapped with a tax.
And they're shutting down. I mean, my understanding is Purdue's going away.
Yeah, but I mean, the argument you could make there is like, this family, the Sacklers, you know, and these executives, they're basically just retiring. It's not like they're actually having to answer for their crimes, and it's not like they're actually going to see any. Are they going to be in the poorhouse now because of these things that have happened? Absolutely not. And Ben, the thing that this makes me think of, and we constantly are running up into things that make me think this, is at the end of the day, we as a government and many governments, so many, just don't have any moral high ground, don't have any like moral soapbox to stand on. Ever. Because at the end of the day, there's so many of these little calculations that involve knowingly allowing terrible things to happen, terrible people to continue doing terrible things under our watch. And yet our politicians try to take some kind of moral stance and say, we are the, you know, law and order candidate or party or whatever. And it's all bull.
I agree. I mean, look, honestly, a great deal of the concept of morality is a PR spin that is sold to a population, which I know sounds brutal and cold. And I'm not saying that the people expressing those values do not themselves believe in them. I think often they do, but those are also tremendous rationalizations. Countries do not have friends. Countries have interests. Right. When you get to that level, we know, however, that single individuals can and do make a difference, such as the reporters we've cited in today's episode. This reporting led to action in Congress, which I'm happy to report. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon introduced something he called the Saudi Fugitives Declassification Act of 2019. This is not aimed at prosecuting these nationals, because legally, again, due to extradition treaties, the ball is in the kingdom's court. Like, it would spark a war if the U.S. sent someone in to extract a Saudi national. That is one of the dumbest things that the U.S. could possibly do. And I know lately it seems like our international actions are based on answering that question. What is the dumbest thing we could do next? Well, but this has been a long time.
That's been happening for a while.
That's true. But this is not... this is not something in the cards, is what I'm saying. So the Fugitives Declassification Act is made to compel the U.S. federal government to publicly disclose what it knows about Saudi Arabia's suspected role in helping citizens escape prosecution. So we're government employees. If you're a U.S. citizen, technically, they all work for you. So this is a bill by one of your employees that is telling some of your other employees to give us more details about the job they're supposed to be doing for you. And that's going to run into a lot of loopholes, because when anytime counterterrorism comes up, there's going to be a lot of redaction of stuff, right? We can only imagine.
Yeah, you know, we talked earlier about needing serious evidence to be able to outright publicly accuse the Saudi Arabian government of taking these actions, right? And really what, to me, this bill reads as, hey, if you actually know that this is happening, show us the evidence and lay it out on the table somewhere so we can really show that this is what's happening. And again, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon is, like you said, Ben, as an employee of the people of Oregon, it seems like he's doing it for those people who, like, we're talking about that 15-year-old at the very start of this episode who was killed in that hit and run accident. Hopefully that's what it would mean.
Is there something special about Oregon or the Pacific Northwest that's led to so many of these cases happening there? Or is this just kind of like a microcosm of the bigger picture?
It's an interesting question. I would say that to a degree, it's a microcosm, bigger picture. And to a degree, it's based on it. It's in the Northwest. Because you asked this question earlier. Mm-hmm. To a degree, it's the nature of how the initial incidents were reported and then discovered and collated. But make no mistake, this is not a Northwest specific thing.
Yeah.
No. Nor, as we'll find, is it a U.S. specific thing. Nor, as we all know, do bills always become laws. There are tons of, everybody remembers that song, right?
Yeah, I'm just a bill.
I love that one. So it's right up there with the, that conspiracy animation that played once on Saturday Night Live, which I think you guys remember. But the thing is, this bill was signed into law. The current presidential administration signed it late last year, toward the end of last year. Now the question is, will it be enforced? But we have to be honest. This is an issue that is not restricted to college students. It is not restricted to the United States. It is not restricted to Saudi Arabia. I would say this is one of the cases we talked about off air. Like, consider the case of someone named Maid Abdulaziz Al Saud. So in 2015, this guy, who's a member of the royal family, is living in Beverly Hills. And a lot of really well-off folks from the Gulf will have a mansion in Beverly Hills, just like how, you know, you've really made it in the financial elite when you have a dope house in London. So this guy became the subject of a civil suit, not a criminal suit, in Los Angeles when three women claimed he hired them as housekeepers and then forcibly confined them for 3 days to this crazy drug sex partying montage at his Beverly Hills mansion, like assaulted them, held them captive. got really weird with it. King Joffrey style. Or what's that other guy? Ramsay Bolton? Yeah. Yeah.
Although he was more just into torturing people. I think Joffrey might be a more, well, they were both pretty into torturing people and excess. You're spot on, Ben.
So we do want to say we're going to share some of the stuff that this fellow was accused of doing. He was, did weird things. It wasn't like the typical, and I hate to say it that way, but it wasn't like what you would always think of when you think of sexual assault. It wasn't just that. Like, he did try to force these people to perform sexual acts on him, but he also did stuff like take off his clothes and like rub himself on literally everybody else in the mansion. These poor women, his security guards, like people who are just by the pool. And he was saying stuff like, lick me, lick my whole body. And I maybe it's just the fact that no one has ever said no to him. Then he ordered his entire staff to get naked by the pool and said vulgar things to him. And one woman protested. And that's when he told her this.
Yeah, he said, you're not a woman, you're nobody. I'm a prince, and I'll do what I want, and nobody will do anything to me. So clearly an ingrained attitude. And then he, you know, triggery stuff here, folks, if you haven't already kind of warned it, but double trigger warning. He tried to urinate on people, make them watch another man perform a sex act on him. And you know, this is a person that has not and most assuredly will not be prosecuted.
And this, of course, isn't the only case we're looking at. There's so many here, we're not going to name them, but let's look at the case of Prince Saud bin Abdulaziz bin Nasir Al Saud, who in 2010 was convicted of murdering his servant, Bandar Abdulaziz, with whom he had been carrying on a sexual relationship. It was pretty terrible. Bandar was beaten, strangled until he died. It was described as a drunken rage that the prince had entered into when this occurred. And the prince, believing that he would have some kind of diplomatic immunity, wasn't necessarily afraid of any repercussions. However, the UK did move forward with custody. They took him in and attempted prosecution.
Right, right. And this case is interesting because there's a question of whether or not the prince actually wanted to return to Saudi Arabia after what was revealed in the court proceedings, because publicly revealing that he was in a same-sex relationship of any sort could make him liable for the crime of homosexuality in Saudi Arabia, which could lead to the death penalty. So he would want to, you know, if his life is on the line, he may have needed to seek asylum in the UK after serving his sentence, because the UK has non-medieval laws. In 2013, however, the prince was, in an extraordinary move, returned to Saudi Arabia to a prison ostensibly to serve out his sentence. Again, that's extraordinary. We will see what actually happens. The laws are just different. And this is making another this is creating another problem in the U.S. that we have to talk about toward the end. These cases in the U.S., which are terrible, have led to Islamophobic, anti-Muslim forces, right? They've taken this stuff up and they're stereotyping somehow all people from Saudi Arabia or all people from the Islamic world as exactly like the criminals in question here, which is terrible. It's one of the worst things to take away from this. Ginger Mooney, who we mentioned at the beginning, served as defense attorney for several individuals in the Oregon cases. She's received death threats, anti-Muslim propaganda. She had to temporarily close her practice. people are using this as a way to sow religious persecution and division, which is unclean. But the point is here that it doesn't seem it's religion that matters. It just seems like money and things like counterterrorism or geopolitical relationships weigh heavily on the scales of justice. Go back to Afghanistan and look at how much trouble members of the military got into when they refused to allow child abuser warlords to function as normal. You know what I mean? They got discharged, I believe, in some cases, because they would find like literal children chained up to be abused by people who are like police chiefs, and they were told not to do anything about it. And I mean, that's what's happening. It's a series of compromises to a greater good. And sometimes, and you know what, in terms of counterterrorism, it seems like the end goal just keeps moving. Right? There's not a finish line. It's not like other nations are necessarily different. We have the case of Anne Sokolos here in the U.S., wife of a U.S. diplomat, struck and killed a teenager, a 19-year-old in the United Kingdom while driving on the wrong side of the road. Is not going to get in trouble for it whatsoever.
When you're important and you're wealthy, it really is a different system. And it's pretty
Prince
damn
Andrew.
Depressing.
Yeah, Matt, dude. Prince Andrew.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, I really didn't want to think about him today.
Sorry.
Damn it, Ben.
Sorry, guys. But that's where we're at. And now we want to pass the torch to you. What do you think? Let us know. I mean, is it, Noel, Matt, is it overly cynical or negative to say that this is probably going to continue? What do you guys think?
I mean, it's, I think, realistic based on the patterns that we've seen, based on how difficult it is to actually enforce this stuff because of the complicity of folks in power on our side.
Well, I mean, in folks in power everywhere. It's complicity across the globe when there's power and strategic advantage to being friends, right? We talked about that numerous times. There are no friends in politics in this way, but there are strategies, there are allies, there are dominoes that can be set up, and there are levers that can be pulled. And when that is so important, specifically the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, you know, because of resources, because of position, where they are, the historic wealth that exists in the kingdom. I mean, what are you going to do? You like you said, Ben, you can't send in a team to extract someone. You can't really do anything besides take a flashlight and shine it on the stuff that we know. And hopefully, good God, hopefully that bill goes through and at least it will be a known thing. But even then, people have to care enough to care.
Yeah. And one thing that we didn't get to, an excellent point you raised, Noel, is that there has to be complicity on the U.S. side. I would argue not just the high level stuff. Obviously, people made a cost benefit analysis there, but someone has to monitor the planes flying in and out, right? Someone works at the airport, you know, someone greenlit this stuff.
I mean, I remember being on a grounded flight one time because of like, you know, runway trouble, or I don't remember exactly what it was. Maybe there was a mechanical thing, but I got off the plane to like get a snack and they wouldn't let me back on the plane like until they reboarded. Like there are serious guidelines and like regulations that go into who can and cannot get back onto planes, procedural kind of situation that is, held to ironclad by these folks. So,
but we're talking about private flights, right? We're talking about a handful of people that are on a plane.
No, that's a good point. I didn't even think about
that. G6. So popular.
Oh, is it G6?
Oh, no, I don't have the specifics of the plane. Actually, right now, unless this Declassification Act shakes something loose, the official word is we're not sure about the specifics of how people are getting out. We haven't been able to find a specific plane, a specific airport, a specific route. But
yeah, but I mean, that's kind of the point. If it's a smaller plane on a smaller airport, I mean, the amount of complicity that would be necessary from a government agency, I think, would be minimum.
Yeah, no, you're spot on there, Matt. I completely agree.
I've got Yeah, I agree. I do have to give one shout out. So this is not just a terrible negative ending. I do have to give one shout out to the time that the U.S. said, yes, we will invade your country and we will snatch people up and take them back. It's not Saudi Arabia. It's the Netherlands. It's the Invade the Hague Act. Do you guys remember this one?
Invade the Hague.
The American Service Members Protection Act of 2002. Authorizes the use of military force to liberate any American or citizen of a U.S. allied country being held at the International Criminal Court.
Wow.
So the idea is that in that case, the U.S. will invade and will extract an individual. But I think that's meant to protect various VIPs in the U.S. from war crime accusations.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That is heinous, though.
Yeah, so the Netherlands, that technically is number one as far as extractions. But now we want to hear from you. Let us know, is this calculation brutal, cold, though it may be? Is it ultimately correct? Is there something else that should be done? What should federal authorities say to the families, right? And what does this mean for the future? You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. We like to recommend Here's Where It Gets Crazy. There is a quiz. Just say our names, all of us or one of us. Say something that lets us know you heard the episode. Say something ponderful that makes us laugh. Give us your best bad dad jokes. But if you don't love social media, then you can also just give us a ring.
Yep, that's 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave us a message. Try to keep it brief. If you can fit your story into 3 minutes or less, that is golden on our end. And please let us know if you are okay with us sharing it, because you may be aware we now do weekly listener mail shows, and these voicemails are a big part of that.
That's right. And check out YouTube. YouTube.com/conspiracystuff. Check out all of our videos. They're all hanging out there. And watch clips from these episodes of the podcast that we're making right now.
And teaser, we have more episodes on the way. We're still working during a pandemic. So honestly, our video team is great. We just have to keep uploading these files.
Yeah, I know. Mine are still going right now. My video files from like the last 2 weeks are going up right now.
So we have some surprises for you on the way. Do tune in. But hey, you might be saying, I like YouTube, but those videos aren't up yet. I hate phones because it's 2020 and calling people is kind of offensive. And I don't like social media because I listened to your other episodes about how terrible social media is. I have something to tell you. How do I talk to you? Well, we have good news. You can contact us wherever you are, whatever time you wish, whenever the spirit moves you, at our good old-fashioned email address, where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.